Members of the Commonwealth Club and guests, among the smaller allied nations, there certainly is no nation that has deserved our admiration to a greater extent than Norway. Following the German conquest, she fought on at the side of Britain, the United States, and Russia. Her sea losses in men and ships, as you know, were greater proportionately than that of any other allied nation. Our speaker, Brynjolf Bjørset, is one of those valiant Norwegians. In 1940, he was in the Norwegian Navy, Coast Defense Division. He fought after the invasion of Norway by the Germans. He fought during those 62 days, then was able to escape into Sweden. He returned to Norway, went to Petsamo, and left Petsamo in a Finnish ship. He knows 12 languages, and was forcible enough in one of them to talk the German consul into letting him go. How, nobody knows. After getting to the United States in 1941, on which occasion he talked to this club, he returned to Europe and with the British forces fought in Europe until the termination of the war. He was on his way to the Pacific Front when VJ Day occurred. It's an honor to introduce to the Commonwealth Club an able and courageous Norwegian officer, Captain Brynjolf Bjørset, who will speak to the club on the subject, Can the Small Nations Come Back? Captain Bjørset.
Mr. Chairman, gentlemen, standing here again on this platform after more than 4 years and being asked the same question as that time, can the small nations come back? I feel somehow as if time has been standing still, and perhaps in some manner it has, because although since then a good many of the small nations have come back, and very definitely so, other nations are still eclipsed, their fate in the dark. Before going into that question, I have a question on my lips. Why does a great nation like the United States care about whether small nations come back? One representative of one big nation, Emperor William II, who led Germany into World War I, but did not let it lead it out again, expressed his feeling in these words: the pitiable status of the small nations. It may be that those contemptuous words covered a certain envy, because perhaps he was aware of the fact that most of the small nations of Europe happened to be run more efficiently than his own nation, and in fact more efficiently than any of the big nations of the continent of Europe. Although some of them, for instance Norway, Denmark and Switzerland, was very much poorer in natural resources even compared to the individual, their people had a higher standard of living, was more content, more happy than the people of Germany or other continental big nations, and they had the same they did the same for culture in Europe, for science, in proportion to their numbers. Of course, we know that in this hemisphere, the position is reverse. Coming back to Europe, not all the nations looked at it as the German Kaiser. The English, in 1939, went to war. Even being unprepared, perilled her own existence because the small nations, one by one, was gobbled up by the Nazis, beginning with Poland and Czechoslovakia. And when I left Los Angeles in January 1940 to go to Norway and eventually take part of an invasion I expected to take place, a big husky Irish policeman on the quay Los Angeles said, "Well, if the Germans really do invade Norway, then see, we, the United States, will come over and clear up for you." As you know, the United States did. Why this interest in the small nations? Well, as already stated, they show they are better run than many of the big nations, and in international trade, for instance, they do not insist, they do not exert pressure to export more than they import. They have no thoughts up their sleeves. They are, as it were, tender meat in the international body. At the same time, they form a certain political balance. If the Nazis had gobbled up all the small nations, they would have been a threat for the whole world. So, England went to war because the small nations were gobbled up, and America, apart from the Pearl Harbor, I know that about half of America were inclined to go to war in Europe because of that, and they came to Europe and cleared up. Now, instead of theorizations, let me tell a few stories about the meeting of representatives of one great nation and one small one, which I know something about, the situation in Norway. When first the German soldiers came to Norway, after 7 years of peaceful quests under Nazi rule, they gobbled Norwegian cream cakes and butter and chocolate in the streets until they vomited, because at home they had been accustomed to a fare which was expressed in Göring's word, "We give them guns for butter." In economic figures, it was expressed in that way that the Germans spent 70% on armaments in 1939 and 30% on the people. That is to say, corresponding to about $10 billion was all the national income devoted to consuming, while in America it is between 100 and 200 billion. We may say that in peacetime, America has a 10 times as high a living standard as the Germans in wartime. During wartime, the Americans had 5 times as high a standard of living. After the Norwegians had been, in the beginning they were a little stunned, after they had taken measure of the situation and had gathered courage and sentiments as to how to meet this enemy, they organized an underground movement, of which I will give a little picture. It was not only cunning, but it was a matter of character and courage. Now, for instance, let us meet electrical engineer Överby and 3 of his friends on the Swedish border. They are crossing, each one with a suitcase full of guns and munitions. Generally, they can escape the German Gestapo on the border by taking note of the time they are supposed to do their patrols. The Germans are always very accurate as to time, and when we know when they used to be patrolling, we can always go at other times. But in this special case I'm giving you today, they are not so lucky. They meet the Gestapo. They know exactly what to do. The Gestapo says, "Let me see your passports." They put down their suitcases, put both their hands in the trousers pockets. The left hand they take out with the required paper. The right hand remains in the trouser pockets, and they make no effort to hide that something is pointing at each one of these Gestapo men. And now comes the fateful questions. These Gestapo men see the things pointing at them, and the Norwegians know that although the Gestapo would like to catch and fry, and although they are servants of a very great nation, for them it's a question of the price. They would not be enthusiastic to catch these Norwegians if they are to die for it or to be wounded. The Norwegians, on the other hand, have at that time arrived at another kind of consciousness. For them, there is no consideration except victory. They are a cog in the great wheel fighting for principles, and they have no hesitation, and the Gestapo knows that. But one of these Gestapo men is unfortunate enough to ask the fateful question, "Well, what have you got in those bags?" My friend Överby looks at him and says, "Well, have a look, won't you? That is your duty, isn't it, to look?" At this time, the pointedness from the trousers pocket is very fierce, and the Gestapo men say, "Oh, I guess it's all right," and let him go. They have the idea that they can catch them afterwards, and they do. But then, in the meantime, these suitcases are disposed of, and nothing more happens. This is only one of a great many activities going on. They belong to the Milorg. There is one organization called the Milorg, which meant military organization. There is a Civorg, which includes all the things you read about in the papers, such as teachers and clergy's front against the Nazis. There is a central leadership who is a liaison between the two, and there was the leadership of the home front, which included and encompassed the whole. All these different organizations were not made and organized from the start, but they grew gradually out of little groups of people who had come together in an effort to form the underground movement. Not always did the Norwegians take the trouble to carry their arms across the border. Sometimes they let the Germans do that for them and attacked and successfully abducted the whole contents of German munitions trains. At other times, one of my near friends lived in Germany at this time and managed to pack guns and munitions in big wooden cases, very heavily bandaged so that the customs officers didn't take the trouble to look through them, and these cases went safely from Germany to Norway. But the greatest part of the arms were dropped from the air by planes from Britain, and for that purpose we had a special unit, two companies of Norwegian soldiers who had parachuted down from planes from England in the summer of 1942. Under the leadership of an officer who was a brother of the movie star Sigrid Guri. And these people lived on and off these snow planes all the time until the Liberation Day. The Germans knew that something was there, and they combed the snow plane again and again, never obtaining any result. They believed, in fact, that the whole division was up there. This group received the arms from the air and distributed them to the Norwegian home forces, which by and by numbered 40,000, a greater standing army than Norway has ever had. And also they trained these home forces, that is to say, they took the boys up to them, trained them, and sent them down to the valleys where they trained others. And of course, when they had been armed, as they had been armed and trained, their great desire was to go out and fight the Germans, and they had heard about what the Yugoslavs did, and no, they just wanted to go out and do something. But that is where they had to resign their intentions. There was a crossfire of angry messages between London and the Norwegian underground at that time, and the high command from London had to send an officer all the way, a major all the way, through Sweden and into Norway to talk to these groups and said, for God's sake, don't go out and shoot Germans now, because we have a much more important job. And finally they were convinced, but there were some efforts at lynching these officers who came over and told them. But what was this more important task that the Norwegian underground had to perform? Well, apart from one thing, they had to be ready for an invasion and to have as few losses as possible, and to be also ready for the surrender, if that came. But that I will come back to. There was another very important thing. In the southern part of Norway, there was a big waterfall where Norwegians before the war had managed to split an atom, the hydrogen atom of water, and they made something called heavy water. The Germans immediately took over this plant when they came to Norway, and we soon learned, that is to say, a few people learned, that this heavy water was an essential link in the production of the German version of the atomic bomb. It is the same link as the Americans have in their plutonium. The Germans didn't get it that way. They had heavy water instead. And we believe that the Germans were ready to use the atomic bomb in 1943 already, if they had had this essential thing from the Norwegian waterfalls. And one day, they were almost ready with the heavy water, and they had already loaded a ferry transporting it to the ocean. At the same time, a week before, 11 Norwegian paratroopers had jumped down joining the Norwegian unit in the mountains. They went through a tunnel into the factory, told the Norwegian workers there would be an explosion, so they had better not go out, but because that would make the Germans aware of the thing, but just go up on the second floor. The Norwegian workers were accustomed to believe in the underground, but perhaps they didn't feel quite happy. Anyway, they did go up there, and after a while there was a formidable thud, but no one was hurt. They went down and found every part of the machinery connected with the heavy water destroyed, but nothing else. And the fuses were so short that the Norwegians were just outside of the hall before the explosion came. Some Germans in the guardhouse went out and looked around, and four triggers were ready to push them down, but they went in again, thinking that it was one of these landmines. Anyway, the 11 parachute troopers went the 400 miles through the mountains to Sweden without any more incident. This didn't happen once, but three times in 1943, 44, and 45. And last time, my good friend Professor Tronstad, who was in charge of these things, a professor of chemistry of international renown and quite young, went with the paratroopers, because then it was very urgent indeed. And he was killed in the battles that ensued. But many of his friends are proud of the fact that he helped to make Norway a chain in the incidents that led to the destruction of the German atom bomb and made it impossible for them to use it. Otherwise, already in 1944, in the autumn, the Germans had ready rockets to reach America. And being very thankful for what the Americans have done for the liberation of Norway, we have a certain pride in thinking another chain of thoughts, that the underground activities in Norway may have saved New York, Chicago, or San Francisco from being blotted out by a German version atom bomb. That is one way in which Norway was trying to come back. Because at this time I want to say that we had reasons, there were internal reasons for Norway getting into the state. That doesn't defend the state of occupation. That doesn't defend the Germans at all. But of all these small nations in Europe, you know, some have at some time been great, and among them, Norway. In fact, there was a time when a Norse king thought nothing of invading and occupying England before breakfast in the morning. And after that, we became rather self-satisfied and lost ambition. Some may call it decline, others would call it that we reach mental maturity. Anyway, we reached it to such an extent that we were so self-satisfied that we thought nothing would happen and we didn't need to prepare. We had lost interest in being a great and aggressive nation, so why would anyone be interested in us? We were occupied with our own quarrels. We were a very beautiful little picture of the isolationist position until Germany came and taught us something else. I would say that we, like the big nations and the other small nations, we deserved to have a shock, and we got it. And that shock made us very much more aware of the world around us. This group in the mountains that had so successfully played a part in the destruction of the German version atom bomb continued for another task, to prepare the Norwegian home forces for either an invasion or the surrender. It was generally said in the papers here that the Germans would continue their fight in Norway after defeat on other fronts, and certainly that was their purpose, that we know. But the Norwegians had agents. In the first place, the whole Norway was divided into districts, and each district had their senders to England. And one of my best friends was the head of the sender near Oslo, And this sender was able all the time to send messages of the feelings, not only in the German High Command, but in all kinds of German headquarters, the Gestapo, the SS. They went to Norwegian secretaries of the high Nazi bigwigs and said to them, well, you are working for the Germans. They would say, well, we are very sorry, we couldn't help it, and so on. Doesn't matter, that's all right, but now you have an opportunity to reverse your status. You will continue to work for them, but also for us. In most cases, they complied. In some cases, they didn't dare to, but never did they dare to betray the Norwegian underground people to the Germans. That would have meant instantaneous death. Not only Norwegians, however, but even Germans were approached. And a German Captain Gallen and a colonel who had been in a Nazi concentration camp but taken out because of his great ability were working with the Norwegian underground all the time, working, giving information, and also working on the German High Command, explaining to them how silly it would be to make resistance. And as another argument was, we are the Norwegian Home Forces, and that by and by grew up, and although they were fought down and captured and put into jail in some districts, on the whole, the Germans didn't dare to touch them too much. They existed with a loss of a few hundred until the day of liberation, and they were fierce people. They couldn't be tinkered with. They surrounded by and by the important German points. They just camped or bivouacked outside these points and stayed there, armed to the teeth with Tommy guns and modern small arms. They surrounded Quisling Place a while before the surrender, and as he was known to begin a private surrounding of his own place by his own guards, and they made a bigger ring around those guards, and they telephoned to him, you'd better make a short cut of it and surrender, because you may see what is around your place. And he sent out his chief of staff in an armored car, and he took a look at the grim faces of these boys and came back. And Quisling did telephone and said yes, he thought he should rather surrender, but wouldn't Mr. Erlandsen please wire the Norwegian Crown Prince and ask for special kind and lenient treatment because of the great services that he offered to the Norwegian nation during these 5 years of occupation. Well, said Mr. Erlandsen, we will see about that. After a while, however, one of Quisling's ministers, who evidently had another opinion, phoned and said, perhaps that proposed wire was a little undiplomatic in its form. Yes, perhaps it was. Well, wouldn't you, Mr. Erlandsen, who is a sensible fellow, make some changes before you send it on? I said that if these people who were engaged by the underground would have squealed, something would have happened to them. Why? Because in Norway there was, during the German occupation, a secret police. Well, you would think this was the Gestapo or some of the German secret polices. No, gentlemen, the Germans never succeeded in having any secrets for the Norwegian underground, but the Norwegian underground had a police that was so secret that the Gestapo had no idea about it until the day of liberation. It was governed by five old-timers in the Norwegian police corps. They were never Quislings themselves, but they did have some few agents who were for a show. They managed to tap every telephone conversation going to or from Gestapo headquarters. They opened and took note of every letter that came into or went out from Gestapo or other German headquarters. So they had a pretty good file at the time of liberation. They took down shorthand notes of all the telephone conversations. But apart from that, they even made arrests and did executions of people during the occupation. Many German Nazis, of course then only those who were necessary in order to protect the underground, many German Nazis found themselves suddenly kidnapped, brought to a court of inquiry where they were fairly tried, and if they weren't guilty, they were interned somewhere for the rest of the war. Otherwise, they just disappeared. And Norwegians, too, were taken in, questioned, and either they disappeared or they went over in the Norwegian underground. The head of Norwegian police, who had been appointed in London, made a trip all the way to Norway into Oslo in 1944, had conferences with the secret police and went out again. And the chiefs of the secret police several times went over to Sweden and had conferences with the Norwegian minister of law and went back again. I think the Gestapo would have liked to know. Even the children took part. And once a wife of an important underground man were kidnapped, brought to the Gestapo headquarters, questioned, together with a 10-year-old girl. In the course of the questioning, she had to tell some little things that were not strictly true. The little girl of 10 was questioned too, and she kept to the same story, wide-eyed. Coming back, she said, "Mother, after the war, will it again be a sin to tell a lie?" By the way, this mother had told her child that their house was bomb-proof because she wouldn't have the child to worry. And the child said, "Yes, mother, yes." And just on Liberation Day, the little child of 10 years looked at her mother and said, "Mother, you often told us that this house was bomb-proof, didn't you?" "Yes, my dear." "Well, dear mother, did you really believe that?" The transmission from wartime to peacetime seemed to happen very harmoniously in Norway, because something had happened before the actual surrender. The Norwegians had been thinking quite a lot. Some had been thinking in the jails and some outside about the reasons why they had come into the state of occupation. To blame the Germans was easy enough, but that is not satisfactory. And in fact, the Norwegians are not so much concerned with the German crimes and with their own criminals as with the status of the whole people. And they thought that their own quarrels and self-conceit before the war had contributed to the state in which they were. And the political parties, for one thing, began to approach each other. And 2 months before the surrender, they had decided not only to get along better than before, but to issue the very same program for the restoration after the war. And this program doesn't contain one of the old usual words, big words with foreign accents. It just tells them plainly what the parties propose to do to raise the economy of the country privately. Every party from communists to rightists have decided, for instance, that the shipping fleet that was during the war run by the government shall be returned to private ownership, which in that branch certainly have proved in Norway to be much more efficient. It doesn't hold good for all kinds of enterprises, for instance, not for the railways in Norway. They are efficiently run by the state, but for the ships it certainly do. And when we are at ships, I would say that that is the only thing Norway needs now. And she doesn't need to get ships, but to buy them. She has the money because the 60% she lost of her shipping fleet were assured in international societies. And we have learned with a certain apprehension that the Americans are going to chop up their Liberty ships. Now, Liberty ships aren't always good for any kind of transport, but Norwegians certainly would be glad to buy them for the price that they can pay in their ship owneries. And that is really, for the moment, the only things Norwegians do need to get their shipping fleet restored so that their peculiar economy can balance. Norway has to import much more than she exports, and the balance is the shipping. And Norway is one of the very few countries where shipping is done without any national subsidy, which proves also that it is run efficiently by the private owners. It can compete even so with other countries where it is run with a subsidy. Coming back to these political parties, they issued this same statement, and as soon as Liberation Day came, they appeared as practically one party. And one other thing, the Norwegian government in London, coming home and having conducted the national affairs pretty good, in exile, many people asked them to stay on, and they said, no, definitely not. Now is the time for the people of the underground. It was easy to do it in Norway because the underground comprised 99.5% of the whole nation. It was solidly behind, the whole nation was solidly behind those people who belonged to the underground. By the way, this secret police discovered through their telephone tappings and all that exactly 17,000 Norwegians were independable and had to be arrested. 17,000 seems a great number, but compared to 3 million, it is much less than 1%. So it is perhaps not more than would be natural for any good nation. And anyway, I've met many of these people. They are weak-minded rather than criminal. Some are criminal, and they have been given meat out their punishment. But it was, after all, the lower strata of Norwegians, those whose character couldn't stand when it was put to the test. So the situation was clear, and they could do this. And it is an old custom, not lived up to just before the war, but it is an old custom from hundreds of years ago that the Norwegian should never try to get into power or to be a prime minister or anything. The people should rather go out in the streets and in the fields and get the prime minister there. And they should never have a wish to stay any longer than the opponents of his regime in the country wants him to stay, I would almost say. That is to say, he should be reluctant to be renewed, to have his powers renewed. That is the attitude which has been very important for the interior, spirit in Norway. Apart from politics, a newspaper was launched directly upon the liberation with the capital enough to go on as a first-class newspaper, but backed by no special interest, no political party, no advertisers. Some people with means decided to do that and to leave the management of the paper to some young people who had thrown out the idea, and they are to replenish their own board. And this paper is appearing now daily in Oslo, continuing the dreams of perhaps an ambitious nation. I don't believe that this sweet agreement will continue forever, but it means a definite step, after all, in the Norwegian's development, a step towards a much greater cooperation and realization of the real things in political life. I have seen, coming now to other nations, I have seen similar tendencies, especially in Holland, although that's one of the nations that have been most hardly hit, and they need much more than ships. They need practically everything. And so does Poland and Greece. Apart from those three countries, no one in Europe, apart from Germany, of course, really do suffer today. That is an exaggeration when it is said that that is so. But some of them need special things. Norway ships, Denmark ships and fuel. Norway also fuel. But real starvation is only happening in those three countries. I saw such tendencies in Holland, in Belgium, although the Belgian government, which was one of the first ones liberated, made the mistake of coming home and promising the people all kinds of things and insisting that they were the only ones who could carry on. Even in Greece, in happy Greece, there has been tendencies to this cooperation lately. But, and as to Greece, England has been very much blamed for her interference, but in fact, it couldn't be helped. The Greeks leftists were stupid enough to use the arms that Americans and English had produced for the liberation against their own people and against the liberators. So interference had to be, but it might have taken another form. It should have, I think, swept out all Greek governments for the time being and said, we have to take over as a military administration. And then under military administration, they might have had a real good election. And that would have turned out Greek as a better coming back nation. Now coming to the other nations who has not come back, such as Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Latvia, and partly Finland. There are two questions to consider, those nations themselves and the great problem, the great question mark, Russia. I stayed in Finnmark with the Russians for a couple of months. They behave excellently there now. There was some trouble in the beginning. Russian soldiers sometimes childishly put up their guns and said, tick, tick, meaning, let me get your watch. When Norwegians told the Russian authorities that that was not the way we wanted to have it with a friendly ally, they stopped it at once. And Russian soldiers now behave better than I've seen any soldier apart from the GI, who behaves marvelously everywhere. Now, a congressman asked me the other day, what is Russia really after? That question kept me thinking. And I would say, Russia doesn't know. There are some people in Russia who have their ideas, some members of the government and others. But in Russia, as in any other country, there are so many groups and so many opinions. And Russia, more than anyone else, has launched on a new venture. She has, after all, turned towards the Western powers in an alliance of arms. And all Russians are not clever, cunning people who are trying to lead us behind the light all the time. But, of course, they are interested after their ordeal of having friendly governments around them. But how friendly? Are they insistent upon having communist governments or puppet governments? They were not in Norway. They made some questions indicating that they would like to have had it. When they saw that it wouldn't be a natural thing, they just dropped it. How is now the situation in Bulgaria, in Romania, in Latvia? Are those nations sufficiently stable to put up a good alternative for the present puppet governments? That is a question I cannot answer yes or no. And who could answer yes or no? Who could get the information? Well, excuse me, but I think no one could better than the United States. In the first place, because in this country there are cousins and brothers and relatives of people in all the countries of Europe. And whatever conceited European politicians say, I don't think anyone knows more about European conditions than Americans, than the well-informed Americans, the groups of Americans who have relatives in the corresponding countries. And if the State Department here, I think they do, but if they do make sufficient use of those groups of Americans and send them over, they have excellent means of gauging the situation. Besides, America has a very great power, I need not tell you. Apart from the atomic bomb, Russia, more than anyone, needs your technical skill and your technical gadgets. She could never have won this war if she hadn't had the American trucks, 200,000 of them. That I have heard Russian officers say. They don't always say it publicly to the Russians. In fact, they have been afraid to let the Russians know all about how happy and how satisfied the American and the English and all the democratic people are. I think that may be wise. If the Russians suddenly realized it, they might sweep this government away and get something worse. But by and by, Russians will know. And that is what I see as one of the solutions, that America has to help her to know by exchanging information, by insisting with her powers, commercial powers and military power perhaps, of exchanging information, inviting Russian newspapermen and officials over here and trying to get those invitations reversed and speaking to the Russians and to the people of these small nations who have not yet been liberated, not only through their governments. That is an insult. A government, gentlemen, never represents a nation. It may represent them more or less nearly as the American government and the English government, but it never represents the whole nation. And the nation feels it as an insult when they are only addressed through the government. Let the Russians be addressed by direct broadcasts. Why didn't the Russians address the American nations by direct broadcasts? They can't complain to that. And let this information go on for some years until we know and until the Russians know what we really want and how badly we want it. If you meant something by your invasion of France the 6th of June, if you meant to keep up that interest in the fate of Europe and in the small nations, I believe that at present it is rather important because, as you saw in Norway, any small nation may help to make the atom bomb of the other side, for one thing. So it is rather important to keep up a thorough knowledge of the small nations and to keep up a thorough mutual knowledge and eventually understanding. And when, if that has been going on for some time, if you reach a state when you say we no really know, we know what Russia is after, we know what these small nations can do, we know if Russia is aiming at conquest or just aiming at having friendly neighbors, then you could put down your terms or you could do it in a more diplomatic way. By the way, diplomacy, that is important. I remember in a British officer's hostel in Brussels, they had a sign. As you know, towels were very short at that time. They had a sign, officers, please see to it that your batmen don't, by mistake, put the hotel towel in your kit bag. Well, with that kind of diplomacy, you may ask, what should we use towards foreign nations? Military power, interference, or commercial pressure, or diplomacy? I would say all three. And the time for using this influence will first be when we really know what Russia is after. I have the impression that even the present government, or many members of it, not all members are as desirable as others, but many members of it are investigating and finding out the attitude of their own people before they take a decision. They are not just dictators. And there is one thing to remember. Russia certainly isn't a democracy yet, but she has said that she wants to make a democracy out of the things she's doing now. She has taken over a totalitarian government from the Tsars, and she's proposing to make that by and by into a democratic government. The Nazis, on the other hand, took over a democratic government, which I would say did work well, and proposed, without mincing the words, to make out of that a worse and worse totalitarian government. That may be the difference between these two forms of totalitarian governments. At any rate, we cannot know until we have found out. And that may take some years. We may have to show some patience. But I think it can be done if America has a plan, if she is willing to keep up the good work that she started with the war. It's an old saying in China that when a man saves another man, he has to take care of him for the rest of his life. Well, America may have to take care of Europe for the rest of her life, not economically, but by showing fierce interest in the affairs of Europe. After all, in Europe are your parents or grandparents. Why shouldn't you be somehow interested in them? If America does show this interest and keep it up, and if she's firm and at the same time polite, then after 5 years, it may not be necessary to ask again that question, can the small nations come back?